A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
An armored D9 bulldozer, plates thick enough to shrug off small arms fire, grinding forward through a field that someone spent weeks seeding with anti-tank mines. Behind it, a column of infantry and armor waiting. Nobody moves until that bulldozer finishes its lane. The operator inside, 19 years old, 8 months out of high school, uniform combat engineer. Not a civilian contractor on a day rate.
That's the thing most people get wrong right out of the gate. When you picture ground forces, you picture infantry kicking in doors, tanks churning across open ground, but none of it moves an inch without the engineers going first.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what combat engineers actually do on a daily basis. We've talked about civilian blasting and excavation work before, but the military side is a different creature. What are these soldiers concerned with day to day, from the math of a breaching charge to the psychology of being first through a breach? What kind of training turns a conscript or a professional into someone who can clear a route under fire?
The IDF context makes this especially interesting, because Israel runs on conscription. The Combat Engineering Corps fills its ranks with 18 and 19-year-olds who get intensive technical training and then deploy. The D9 operator, the guy sweeping for IEDs ahead of a convoy, the team calculating how many kilos of explosive to punch through a reinforced wall, these are conscripts, not career contractors.
Which raises the question Daniel's really getting at. What is a combat engineer at the Corps? Are they soldiers who build things or builders who fight? And what does that dual identity look like on a Tuesday morning when there's a minefield between your brigade and its objective?
The formal definition is straightforward. Combat engineers enable mobility for friendly forces and deny mobility to the enemy. Breaching obstacles, clearing routes, constructing fortifications, demolition, bridge building, mine warfare. But the formal definition doesn't capture the weird tension of the role. You're a frontline combat soldier who also has to do trigonometry under pressure.
Trigonometry with consequences. If you get the charge calculation wrong on a concrete wall, you either don't breach it and stall the entire advance, or you overdo it and kill your own breaching team.
We're going to get into the actual math later. The numbers are surprisingly specific, but the point is, this isn't a support role in the rear. Engineers work ahead of the main force. They're the first ones to encounter whatever the enemy left behind.
The daily reality is split between two modes. There's the technical work, maintaining demolition kits, drilling breaching procedures, running the calculations. And then there's the operational work, where all that training meets the mess of actual terrain and actual incoming fire. The D9 operator clearing a lane through rubble in Gaza isn't doing theory. He's coordinating with infantry over radio, while rounds ping off his armor.
That's the part I find genuinely remarkable. The same 19-year-old who was doing high school exams 2 years ago is now making decisions that determine whether an entire armored column moves or stalls. The Combat Engineering Corps takes conscripts through 4 months of basic infantry training, then 4 to 5 months of advanced engineering training at Bahad 14. That's where they learn demolitions, minefield breaching, bridge construction, operating engineering vehicles. 8 or 9 months total from civilian to combat engineer.
Compare that to the Yahalom unit, the Special Operations Engineering Force. Those are professionals, not conscripts. Their training pipeline runs 18 months. 3 months just on demolitions. 4 months on breaching. 2 months on explosive ordnance disposal. They learn to disable nuclear, biological, and chemical threats. The gap in experience between a battalion engineer conscript with 6 months of field time and a Yahalom operator with 8 years is enormous.
Both of them are doing the same fundamental job. Enable movement, deny movement. The conscript might be sweeping a route with a metal detector and a mine prodder, literally a stick, you push into the ground at a 30-degree angle to feel for buried objects. The Yahalum operator might be deploying a carpet line charge to clear a 100-meter path through a minefield in seconds. Same mission, different tools, vastly different experience levels.
The carpet system is worth pausing on, because it sounds like science fiction until you see it. It's a rocket-propelled hose packed with explosives. You fire it across a minefield, it lays out this long line of boom, and then it detonates. The overpressure triggers the mines. 100 meters of safe passage in seconds, but the engineers deploying it have to calculate the angle, the distance, the blast radius. Get any of it wrong and you're in the kill zone.
That's the daily reality. Every breaching operation, every route clearance, every demolition job starts with a calculation. For a 30-centimeter reinforced concrete wall, you're looking at 2 to 3 kilos of explosive per square meter of breach area, placed in drilled holes at specific depths. That's not a rule of thumb, that's what the manuals say, and conscripts learn it in training and apply it under time pressure.
When Daniel asks what they do on a daily basis, the answer is partly that they do math, and then they apply the math while people are shooting at them. The tools range from a simple prodding stick to a 50-ton armored bulldozer to a rocket-delivered explosive hose.
Let's walk through what a non-operational day actually looks like. On a base, a combat engineer's day starts with equipment maintenance. Demolition kits need to be checked and inventoried. Breaching charges have to be stored properly. Temperature, humidity, all of it matters. Mine detectors get calibrated. The Puma armored engineering vehicle gets inspected. Physical training because you're still infantry. Then drills. Standard operating procedures for breaching different types of obstacles, practiced until they're muscle memory.
The Puma itself is worth mentioning. It's a heavily armored personnel carrier modified specifically for combat engineers. It carries breaching equipment, mine clearing gear, demolition charges. The crew inside is a small team of engineers who can deploy directly into an obstacle zone. It's their mobile workshop, basically.
The maintenance and drill day is about readiness. But the operational day is completely different. Route clearance is the most common real-world mission. Before any convoy or armor column moves through contested terrain, engineers sweep the route. Metal detectors, mine-prodding sticks, sometimes explosive detection dogs. In the IDF, this is often done by Yahalom for the high-threat routes or by regular battalion engineers for routine movements.
Route clearance isn't just about mines. It's IEDs, booby-trapped structures, collapsed tunnels that could be rigged. In 2014, an IDF engineer was killed when a booby-trapped tunnel entrance detonated during a breach operation. That incident led to new protocols requiring remote inspection before any manual breaching. Send a robot or a camera in first, verify it's not rigged, then proceed.
Which brings us to the psychological dimension Daniel mentioned. Engineers work ahead of the main force, often alone or in small teams. They're the first to encounter whatever the enemy has prepared. The stress of that is cumulative. The IDF has invested heavily in mental health support for combat engineers specifically, including mandatory decompression time after high-intensity operations. You can't just rotate them back to patrol duty after a week of breaching booby-trap tunnels.
There's a phrase that gets used in the Corps, the engineer's dilemma. You have to move slowly enough to be thorough, because missing a mine gets people killed. But you also have to move fast enough that the operation isn't stalled, because a stalled column is a target. Balancing those two pressures is the core psychological challenge of the job.
It's worth comparing to civilian blasting, which we've discussed before. A civilian blaster plans for weeks. They have safety buffers measured in hundreds of meters. They clear the area, run checklists, detonate from a safe distance. A combat engineer plans in minutes, works under direct or indirect fire, and accepts a risk tolerance that would be unthinkable in any civilian context. Same explosive math, completely different operational reality.
The D9 operator embodies this more than anyone. The IDF uses armored D9 bulldozers, Caterpillar D9s up, armored to withstand small arms fire, RPGs, and IEDs. These are operated exclusively by uniformed combat engineers. The operator is inside a reinforced cab, coordinating with infantry over radio, clearing vegetation and rubble, and suspected IEDs while taking fire. It's one of the most dangerous jobs in the Corps, because the D9 is a big, slow target that has to go exactly where the threats are.
The D9 operator is often a conscript. 19 years old, 8 months of training, sitting in a 50-ton armored bulldozer clearing a path so the infantry behind him can advance. That's not a metaphor, that's a Tuesday.
The answer to Daniel's question starts with this image, a 19-year-old in an armored bulldozer, or a team of engineers probing the ground inch by inch ahead of a tank column, or a Yahalem operator calculating a breaching charge on the back of an envelope, while mortars drop 200 meters away. The daily work is technical, physical, and psychological all at once. And the training pipeline that produces these soldiers, from 4 months of infantry basics to the specialized demolitions courses at Bahad, 14 to the 18-month Yahalom pipeline, is designed to compress years of technical education into months.
Which is where we should go next, because the training is what makes the daily work possible. How do you take an 18-year-old conscript and, in less than a year, make them capable of calculating explosive charges under fire? What does that curriculum actually look like, and what gets left out when you're compressing a civilian engineering degree into a few months of intensive instruction? The curriculum is built on a principle that sounds obvious but is surprisingly hard to execute. Teach the minimum viable knowledge that keeps people alive and effective, and trust that the rest comes from experience. You don't need to understand the chemistry of RDX to use a breaching charge. You need to know how many kilos, where to place it, and what the safe standoff distance is.
Which is a very Israeli approach to training. Strip it down to what works, drill it until it's automatic, then get people into the field where they'll learn the rest. The trade-off is that conscripts arrive at their units with a narrower skill set than a professional engineer in the US Army or the British Royal Engineers, but they arrive faster, and there are more of them.
The professional NCOs and officers fill the gaps. A typical combat engineering battalion has a corps of career soldiers, company commanders, senior sergeants, the guys who've been doing this for 5 or 10 years, surrounded by conscripts on their mandatory service. The career soldiers design the breaching plan. The conscripts execute it under supervision. Over time, the experienced conscripts start making judgment calls themselves.
The training pipeline is really two separate pipelines running in parallel. The conscript track, 4 months of basic, 4 to 5 months at Bahad 14, then deployment. The professional track, same basic training, then up to 18 months of specialized courses, then years of field experience. And the two tracks meet in the same battalion, the same mission, the same minefield.
What's interesting is how Bahad 14 structures the advanced phase. The first chunk is demolitions theory, and this is where the math comes in. Conscripts learn the basic explosive calculations for different materials, concrete, steel, earth, wood. They learn about shape charges versus bulk charges. They learn how to calculate breaching charges for walls of different thicknesses and compositions. It's not a full engineering degree, but it's enough to be dangerous in the right way.
The shape charge is a good example of something that sounds exotic, but is actually a core tool. It's an explosive charge with a conical hollow carved into it, usually lined with metal. When it detonates, the liner collapses into a superheated jet that punches through armor or reinforced concrete. Engineers use them for breaching hardened targets where a bulk charge would be inefficient.
The training covers when to use which. Bulk charge for a standard concrete wall, shaped charge for a reinforced door or a bunker entrance, Bangalore torpedo for wire obstacles, line charge for minefields. Each tool has a specific use case, and the conscript has to learn to identify the obstacle and match the tool under time pressure.
There's also a whole module on soil assessment, which sounds mundane until you realize that the effectiveness of a mine-clearing charge depends partly on what kind of dirt you're dealing with. Sandy soil transmits blast pressure differently than clay. Rocky terrain can fragment in unpredictable ways. Engineers have to read the ground before they can clear it.
Then there's the mechanical side. Not every obstacle gets explosives. Sometimes the right tool is the D9, or an excavator, or a mine plow mounted on a tank. Conscripts learn to operate all of these during the advanced phase. The D9 course alone is several weeks. It's not just driving a bulldozer, it's learning to read terrain, coordinate with infantry, and operate under fire while maintaining situational awareness through a tiny armored viewport.
The viewport thing is no joke. D9 operators have extremely limited visibility. They're relying on radio calls from infantry spotters to tell them what's ahead, what's on the left, what's on the right. and they're doing this while the vehicle is taking hits and the ground might be collapsing under them. The training includes a lot of simulated combat driving where the instructor is screaming over the radio, and the trainee has to process commands while maneuvering a 50-ton vehicle.
That's the conscript pipeline. The Yahalom pipeline is a different animal entirely. 18 months of training after basic. The demolitions course alone is 3 months and goes far deeper. Advanced charge calculations, underwater demolitions, demolition of hardened underground facilities. The breaching course is 4 months and covers every conceivable obstacle type, including ones that most engineers will never encounter outside of a full-scale conventional war.
Then the EOD course, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, is another 2 months on top of that. Yahalom operators learn to disable everything from artillery shells to improvised devices to chemical and biological weapons. The nuclear component is classified, but it exists. These are the people you call when someone finds a missile warhead that didn't detonate, and it's sitting in a residential neighborhood.
The psychological screening for Yahalom is intense, because the job requires a very specific temperament. You need someone who is methodical and careful, the kind of person who double-checks their work, but also willing to walk toward something that might explode. Those two traits don't often coexist in the same personality.
The phrase they use in selection is calculated courage. Not recklessness, not paralysis. The ability to assess a threat accurately and then act despite the fear. It's not something you can train into someone who doesn't have it. You can refine it, but the baseline has to be there.
That brings us to the mistake question Daniel raised. What happens when an engineer gets it wrong? A miscalculated charge that fails to breach a wall is a tactical failure. The advance stalls, the element of surprise, is lost. A miscalculated charge that overpenetrates and kills the breaching team is a catastrophe. And a missed mine during route clearance that destroys a vehicle full of infantry is the worst-case scenario that every engineer trains to prevent.
The 2014 tunnel incident is the example that gets taught in training now. An engineer approached a tunnel entrance to place a breaching charge. The entrance was booby-trapped. The new protocol, remote inspection first, always, was written in response to that death. Which is how military doctrine often evolves. Someone pays the price, and the lesson gets codified so the next engineer doesn't pay it again.
There's also a less visible consequence, which is the cumulative weight of near misses. Engineers who've done multiple tours in high-intensity zones often describe a kind of cognitive fatigue that sets in after months of being the first ones through. Your threat detection stays sharp, but the emotional cost of maintaining that hypervigilance compounds. The IDF's mental health protocols include mandatory decompression cycles. You come out of the operational zone, you get time to reset, and they're screening for signs of acute stress before you go back in.
Which loops back to the civilian comparison. A civilian blaster does one controlled detonation and goes home. A combat engineer might do a dozen breaches in a week, each one under fire, each one with lives directly depending on the math being right. The accumulated stress of that is something the civilian world doesn't really have a parallel for.
Yet the Corps has no shortage of volunteers. The engineering units are consistently among the most requested assignments in IDF conscription lotteries. Part of that is the prestige. Combat engineers are seen as elite, technically proficient, essential. Part of it is that the role offers something rare in mandatory service, genuine technical mastery. You come out of it with skills that have civilian applications. Demolition certification, heavy equipment operation, EOD experience, these translate directly into civilian careers in construction, mining, and security.
The Ministry of Defense working group you mentioned, the one considering a fast-track licensing pathway for combat engineers, that's recognition of exactly this. These conscripts are doing work that in civilian life would require years of apprenticeship and certification. The military compresses that into months, and then the civilian world benefits from the output. Let's get granular on the tools themselves, because the daily decision-making is where the job gets real. You're a battalion engineer, and the order comes down. Clear a lane through that minefield so the armor can push through. What do you reach for first?
The answer depends on three things: time, terrain, and threat level. If you have minutes and the minefield is under enemy observation, you deploy a line charge, the CARPE system. Rocket-propelled hose, 100 meters of explosive, clears a vehicle-wide lane in seconds. But it's loud, it's obvious, and it announces exactly where you're breaching.
which matters if the enemy has spotters or drones. A carpet detonation is basically a flare saying the breach is here. So sometimes the call is to go quiet, manual breaching with Bangalore torpedoes. Those are long tubes packed with explosive, assembled section by section, pushed through wire obstacles or across minefields by hand. Slower, more exposed, but much harder to detect until the breach actually happens.
The Bangalore has been around since before the First World War. The basic design hasn't changed much because it works. You're threading explosive tubes under barbed wire or across a suspected mine strip, then detonating. The blast clears a narrow footpath. For a vehicle lane, you need multiple Bangalores or a wider charge. But the principle is the same, controlled explosion creating safe passage.
The trade-off is time. A carpet clears a lane in seconds, but costs a fortune per shot, and you only carry so many. A Bangalore takes 10 or 15 minutes to assemble and push into place, during which the team is completely exposed. The decision of which to use is the kind of thing a 20-year-old squad leader has to make, often with incomplete information and a company commander yelling over the radio.
Then there's the D9 option, which is its own entire category. If the minefield is in open terrain and you have armor support, you send the D9 with a mine plow attachment. It literally pushes mines aside or detonates them ahead of the blade. The operator is inside an armored cab designed to withstand a mine blast underneath. It's slower than a line charge, but it clears a wider path and doesn't expend a limited munition.
The D9 operator also has to deal with something no other breaching method faces: the psychological weight of driving directly over mines. The cab is rated for it, the armor is rated for it, but your lizard brain doesn't care about the engineering specs. Every bump in the ground could be the one that flips a 50-ton bulldozer.
Which is why D9 operators develop a kind of fatalistic calm. I've read interviews with veterans who describe it as, "The vehicle will do what the vehicle does. My job is to keep it moving." That's not bravado. It's a coping mechanism that lets them function. The training actually reinforces it. They drill mine plowing runs until the motion becomes automatic, so when it's real, the body knows what to do, even if the mind is screaming.
The other daily tool that doesn't get enough attention is the mine prodder. It's literally a stick, a thin metal rod with a handle, that you push into the ground at a 30-degree angle. You're feeling for solid objects beneath the surface. If you hit something hard, you stop, mark it, and either call EOD or bypass it. It's slow, it's exhausting, and it's still one of the most reliable mine detection methods in existence.
Metal detectors miss non-metallic mines. Ground-penetrating radar is expensive and finicky. Dogs are excellent but get tired. The prodder works on everything, every time. The downside is that it requires the engineer to be within arm's reach of a buried explosive. One wrong angle, one moment of inattention, and you've triggered a pressure plate.
That's the daily reality of route clearance. A team of engineers, sometimes just 4 or 5 soldiers, moving ahead of a convoy at walking pace, probing the ground inch by inch. If they find something, the whole column stops. If they miss something, people die. The pressure is enormous, and it's entirely on the engineers.
The math is what keeps them alive. For a typical route clearance operation, the team calculates sweep width, sweep speed, and detector overlap based on the terrain and the expected mine type. Too fast and you miss things. Too slow and the convoy becomes a stationary target. The sweet spot for a manual sweep with prodders is about 1 km per hour in open terrain, slower in urban rubble. That number gets drilled into every conscript at Bahad 14.
1 km per hour. Think about that. A tank can cross that same distance in under a minute. The entire operational tempo of a ground advance is dictated by the walking speed of an engineer with a stick.
That 1 km per hour number is what makes the engineer the bottleneck in every ground operation. It's also what makes the conscript versus professional dynamic so consequential. A battalion commander planning an advance has to decide where to allocate his limited engineering assets. The Yahalom team goes to the hardest breach, the minefield with anti-tank mines and IEDs layered together. The conscript teams handle the secondary routes. But if a conscript team hits something unexpected, the whole timetable shifts.
The allocation problem is brutal, because you can't just throw more engineers at it. Breaching is inherently a narrow front operation. You're creating a lane, and only so many people can work on a lane at once. So the commander is doing triage. Which route gets the experience team? Which route can wait? What's the cost of being wrong?
This is where the training pipeline shows its design logic. The conscript course at Bahad 14 doesn't try to produce Yahalom-level operators. It produces engineers who can execute standard breaching procedures reliably. The assumption is that anything non-standard gets escalated to the professionals. The system is built around that handoff.
The handoff itself is a daily reality. A conscript team hits something they don't recognize. An unfamiliar mine type. A weirdly constructed IED. A tunnel entrance that doesn't match the intel photos. They stop, secure the area, and call it up. Somewhere, a Yahalom team gets spun up. The conscripts hold position and wait, which is its own kind of stress. Sitting next to something that might be rigged, knowing you can't do anything about it.
The 2014 tunnel incident is the case study in why that handoff protocol exists. Before the new remote inspection rules, the default was for the first engineer on scene to approach and assess. That's what happened. An engineer approached a tunnel entrance to place a breaching charge, and the entrance was booby-trapped. The detonation was fatal. After that, the protocol changed. No manual approach until a robot or camera has cleared the entrance. The conscript's job now is to secure the perimeter and wait for the specialist with the remote gear.
During that waiting period, which might be hours, the engineer is just sitting there, looking at the thing that might explode, running through the mental checklist of what they'd do if they had to breach it themselves. The psychological burden of that is something the IDF has had to get serious about. Mandatory decompression time isn't a perk, it's a medical intervention.
The mental health protocols for combat engineers are more intensive than for most other combat roles, because the stress profile is different. Infantry stress is acute. Contact, firefight, resolution. Engineer stress is sustained. Hours of hypervigilance while sweeping a route, followed by minutes of extreme risk during the breach, followed by more hours of hypervigilance. The cortisol cycle never really resets during an operation.
Which brings us back to the civilian comparison Daniel's prompt implicitly raises. A civilian blaster works in a controlled environment. They plan for weeks. They have exclusion zones, safety officers, checklists, and the luxury of stopping if anything looks wrong. A combat engineer has none of that. Same charge calculation, same physics, completely different world.
The math is identical. 2 to 3 kilos per square meter for 30 centimeter reinforced concrete, whether you're demolishing an old parking garage in Tel Aviv or breaching a bunker in Gaza. But the civilian blaster gets to measure twice, cut once, and evacuate the block. The combat engineer is doing the calculation in their head while someone is shooting at them, and the safe standoff distance is whatever cover they can find in the next 10 seconds.
The civilian blaster doesn't have to worry that the wall they're breaching might be rigged on the other side. The booby trap is a variable that simply doesn't exist in civilian demolition. It's the thing that makes every combat breach a gamble. You can calculate the charge perfectly, and still die because the enemy anticipated exactly where you'd place it.
That's what makes the Yahalom training so intensive. The 18-month pipeline isn't about teaching more math. The math is the same. It's about teaching pattern recognition for threats. What does a rigged door look like? How does a command-detonated IED differ from a pressure plate in terms of telltale signs? How do you read the ground for signs of tunneling? That's experience compressed into curriculum, and it's what separates the conscript from the professional.
The conscript knows how to breach a standard obstacle. The Yahalom operator knows how to recognize when a standard obstacle isn't standard. That gap is the difference between a successful breach and a funeral. And the fact that the IDF runs both tracks simultaneously, conscripts and professionals in the same core, same mission, same minefields, is what makes the whole system work. The conscripts provide volume. The professionals provide depth.
That system is what makes the engineer the quiet bottleneck in every ground operation. You can have all the infantry and armor in the world, but if your engineers can't clear the route, nobody moves. The entire tempo of an advance is set by the slowest breach.
Which is the thing Daniel's question really points toward, even if he didn't phrase it this way. When we talk about what combat engineers do daily, we're actually talking about the hidden constraint on modern ground warfare. Walls don't move at the speed of infantry. They move at the speed of engineering.
That constraint is structural, not just tactical. You can't solve it by recruiting more engineers because breaching is inherently a narrow front problem. Only so many people can work a lane. You can't solve it with better technology alone because the carpet and the D9 and the mine prodder all have trade-offs that the enemy adapts to. It's an unsolved bottleneck.
The next time you read about a military operation, a ground incursion, an armored thrust, a raid, the question to ask isn't how many troops are involved, it's who cleared the route. The answer tells you more about the operation's feasibility than any troop count ever could.
If the answer is a 19-year-old conscript with 8 months of training and a prodding stick, you're looking at an advance that moves at 1 kilometer per hour. If it's a Yahalom team with line charges and robotic inspection gear, you might get 10 times that speed. Same mission, same obstacle, completely different operational reality.
The IDF model is instructive here, and not just for militaries. Any organization that needs to combine technical expertise with frontline execution faces the same problem. You can't make everyone a specialist. It takes too long and costs too much. But you can't send untrained people into high-stakes situations either. The solution is the two-track system. Invest heavily in a compressed but rigorous training pipeline for the volume players, and build an elite cadre for the hardest problems.
The conscript who can calculate a breaching charge and deploy it under fire isn't a specialist by Yahalom standards, but they're not a novice either. 4 months of demolitions training at Bahad 14 produces someone who can execute standard procedures reliably. That's the minimum viable product, and it works because the system doesn't ask them to do anything beyond their training. The weird stuff goes to the professionals.
The steep learning curve that conscripts face, from high school to minefield in under a year, is accepted as the cost of the model. The IDF doesn't pretend it can eliminate the gap between a 6-month conscript and an 8-year Yahalom operator. It builds the operational doctrine around that gap instead.
Which is the real lesson. Don't try to make everyone equal, make everyone capable of their assigned task, and create a handoff system that routes the hardest problems to the people equipped to solve them. It sounds obvious, but most organizations fail at it because they're unwilling to accept that their frontline people will have a steep learning curve and will make mistakes.
The engineer's daily reality is the proof that this model works, and also the proof of what it costs. The stress, the hypervigilance, the cumulative weight of being first through every door. That's the price of making the system function. The decompression protocols, the mental health screening, the remote inspection rules written in response to deaths in the field. Those are the institutional acknowledgement that the price is real.
Which raises the question that's going to shape the next decade of this field. As drones get cheaper and autonomous systems get smarter, does the combat engineer's job shift from manual breaching to remote operation? The IDF is already experimenting with robotic mine clearing systems, unmanned ground vehicles that can deploy line charges or probe a route without putting a soldier in the kill zone.
The technology exists. The question is trust. A robot can sweep a route with ground-penetrating radar, but if it misses something, the first vehicle in the column eats a mine. Our commander is ready to stake an operation on a machine's judgment. Right now, the answer is no. The robot augments the engineer. It doesn't replace them. But that line is moving.
The psychological dimension shifts, too. If the engineer is operating a mine-clearing robot from a kilometer back, they're physically safe, but they're still the one making the call that sends a column through. The responsibility doesn't get lighter just because your body isn't in the danger zone. Different kind of stress, same weight.
The engineer has always been the invisible enabler of every ground victory. Infantry takes the ridge, armor punches the hole, but neither moves an inch without someone clearing the path first. They don't get the glory. They get the math, the prodding stick, and the knowledge that if they get it wrong, everyone behind them pays.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, Soviet scientists studying the Aral Sea Basin discovered that local fishermen had developed an inexplicable phobia of perfectly ordinary aluminum rowboats. They would happily use wooden boats in the same waters, but refused to even touch aluminum hulls. When pressed for a reason, the fishermen insisted that aluminum boats remember the water wrong. Interviews revealed that disbelief had emerged spontaneously in at least 7 separate fishing villages with no contact between them. The phobia vanished entirely by 1962, and no one ever figured out what triggered it.
Aluminum boats remember the water wrong.
I have so many questions I don't want answered.
The combat engineer gets it. They don't need the credit. They just need the route to be clear.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us a question, maybe something about the other invisible roles that keep armies moving, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.